Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Douglas Impoga.
It is in this sector that our exports and forex earnings are growing from. It is this sector whose success will give us the capacity to diversify our economy and make it more resilient and sustainable.
Malawi's President Lazarus Chakwera calls on the country to transition from largely subsistence farming to industrialized commercial farming.
We are hearing a lot of topics, innovative finance, blended, de-risking. So it's very important to put a plan going forward where each stakeholder and its role is quite well understood and there's complementarity.
U.S. Climate Envoy John Kerry says that Egypt has been selected to host the COP27 UN Climate Conference due to take place next year.
And without getting assistance for climate investment and installation of climate smart technologies, it will be difficult, plus other issues of environmental conservation.
And a look at how climate change-related shocks, such as prolonged drought, floods, and locust infestation, have displaced thousands of Somali farmers from their land, threatening food security in the Horn of the African state. Those stories and more coming up right here on Nightline Africa. President Lazarus Chakwera has called on the country to transition from largely subsistence farming to industrialized commercial farming. He says the change is crucial to meet the goal of making the country food sufficient by 2030. However, farmers have received the call with a pinch of salt. Lameka Masina reports from Blantyre.
Speaking as he opened the National Agriculture Fair in Blantyre, President Lazarus Chakwera said it is concerning that 80% of farmers in Malawi are small-scale farmers, while the country has vast resources that could transform it into a commercial farming nation.
It is in this sector that most of our jobs are being created. It is from this sector that our gross domestic product, GDP, is receiving its greatest boost. It is in this sector that our exports and forex earnings are growing from. It is this sector whose success will give us the capacity to diversify our economy and make it more resilient and sustainable.
Chakwera said the more the farmers engage in value agriculture and add value to their products, the more they will see their profit margin rise. The president added that his emphasis on agriculture does not mean that he does not dream of Malawi also thriving from tourism, mining, and telecommunication.
It is just that at this stage of our national development, making our agricultural sector a success is foundational to diversifying our economy. The next time you hear someone admiring America's economy, tell them that a big part of what keeps that economy strong and finances its diversification is agriculture.
He said, for example, the United States is the highest producer of corn, the second highest producer of soybeans, and the fourth highest producer of wheat in the world. Chakwera said Malawi is making efforts to transform its agriculture sector. He said that includes the government's emphasis on moving from largely rain-fed agriculture to irrigation farming.
As a case in point, in the 2021-22 national budget, import duty on agricultural machinery was waived precisely to make irrigation equipment more affordable and accessible. In fact, our entire economic policy framework is driven by our unapologetic desire to build an agriculture sector of the future.
However, farmers are skeptical about the president's words. Masauku Kabapa owns the Chimwemwe farm in Kasungu district in central Malawi. He says commercialized farming in Malawi can only be possible if banks are more flexible with farmers.
He says commercial farming in Malawi is impossible because farming equipment and machinery is too expensive for a small farmer, and also to get a loan from banks is difficult because banks tend to ask for collateral, which most farmers cannot manage. Kabapa suggests the government enact policies to restrain commercial banks from asking for collateral. He also says although government has waived duty charges on machinery for irrigation farming, most areas of Malawi still lack necessary equipment. He says most of the dams and water reservoirs that were built for that purpose are not functional and need rehabilitation. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre, Malawi.
South Africa's last apartheid president, F.W. de Klerk, died of cancer Thursday at the age of 85. He's celebrated as the man who released the African National Congress, or ANC, leader Nelson Mandela in 1990. So began South Africa's path to its first democratic multiracial elections 4 years later, which resulted in de Klerk's national party, the NP, losing power to the African National Congress. But as Darren Taylor reports, there was a much darker, more complex side to de Klerk's character.
De Klerk's acknowledged time and again that he was in favor of apartheid in his younger years as an MP stalwart and staunch supporter of whites-only rule. He did so again during a message to South Africa recorded shortly before his death.
Since the early 80s, my views changed completely. It was as if I had a conversion and in my heart of hearts realized that apartheid was wrong. I realized that we had arrived at a place which was morally unjustifiable.
The 1980s remain the most violent period in South African history. Growing numbers of especially black, but also some white citizens were rebelling against apartheid. As the ANC bombed public areas frequented by whites, like shopping centers, so the nationalist regime sent its troops into townships to brutalize black people. The government, of which de Klerk was a senior member, imprisoned thousands of people, its forces killing scores of anti-apartheid activists, including four from the small town of Cradock in the Eastern Cape province in June 1985.
They were driving back from Port Elizabeth back to Cradock when they were ambushed and they were killed.
Lukanyo Tralata is the son of Fort Tralata, one of the men known as the Cradock Four. In 1997, at an amnesty hearing held by South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the TRC, six former apartheid policemen confessed to abducting and executing the four, burning the bodies and dumping them in bush near Port Elizabeth. For much of the 1980s, de Klerk was a member of the government's State Security Council, or SSC. In the early 1990s, SSC documents came to light showing that in the months leading up to the killings of the Cradock Four, it discussed their so-called permanent removal from society. As Tralata points out, minutes of the meetings indicate that de Klerk was present.
So we wanted de Klerk to confirm what he had said in those meetings. We wanted him to tell us the truth about what his role was in the planning and in the conspiracy to murder the Cradock Four. He knew that a crime would be committed, and yet he never did anything to stop it. So as far as we're concerned, de Klerk was a murderer.
In 1996, de Klerk presented the NP's submission to the TRC. He denied any knowledge of political assassinations, blaming them on rogue, low-level operatives within apartheid security forces. Tralata says de Klerk's death frustrates him more than anything else.
What did he say when they were discussing the military signal that was sent calling for the permanent removal of the Cradock Four? This is something that we wanted from him. So his death robs us of that opportunity. And he died with those secrets.
Earlier this year, de Klerk claimed that senior ANC leaders had made deals with his government to prevent prosecutions of apartheid politicians and killers.
Now de Klerk is dead. The ANC must be rejoicing today because their secret about who it was that entered into those deals with the apartheid operatives, de Klerk took that information with him to the grave.
The ANC denies such deals were made, but Tralata says he won't allow it to get away with selling out his father and other martyrs. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
U.S. climate envoy John Kerry has said that Egypt had already been selected to host the COP27 UN climate conference due to take place next year. Each year, a country representing a different region of the world takes over the presidency of the Conference of the Parties, a COP, and the meeting tends to be hosted in that country. Last month, Egypt's president, Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, officially declared his country's interest in hosting the COP27 summit. From Glasgow, where this year's edition was held, Ahmed Fati, a global affairs analyst, talked to Egyptian Minister for International Cooperation, Dalia Armashat, about what it means for Egypt to host such a mega event under the logo of United Africa for the Future.
Well, we're all very pleased to be here at COP26, and we understand how important it is that the next COP is an African COP, and our logo is a United Africa for a Resilient Future, and this is really important. Even though Africa only contributes 4% to total emissions, it is one of the most affected regions. And in the case of Egypt, we have a very good story to tell in terms of the different projects that are linked to mitigation, adaptation, and we want to be able to showcase that and show how our expertise could be also shared with other countries. Tomorrow, the end of the consultations here in Glasgow, and whatever is going to be left on the agenda is going to be pushed with us forward over the next 12 months. We are all very ready and very excited to be the host next time, and we want to make sure that we have an effective 12 months where we land in Sharm el-Sheikh with very practical and on-the-ground solutions.
Egypt's resilience and preparedness for the climate change. And Egypt does not have that many emission levels compared to other industrialized nations. How is the private sector is capitalizing on the abundance of finance we have seen here in the COP26? Literally, it's flushed with cash for those who can come and take it. I'm not speaking about governmental here. I'm speaking about private sector and funding, and whether through the development banks or even through commercial bank, there was an alliance, Citibank, USB, Switzerland, Bank of America, and others who have launching a green fund. And even one of these funds has been put on the exchange in Johannesburg in South Africa. And the same fund is going to be also coming to the NASDAQ very soon. Where is Egypt from all of that compared to other African countries?
So, of course, you know, the word green comes up on so many levels, and ESG is something that different firms are trying to implement. Green finance is something that financiers are trying to guarantee. And green policies is something that governments are trying to activate. So there's a stakeholder engagement focus, a vision that is very shared today. And what is quite important, and this is, you know, we had a panel on innovative financing and trying to create an integrated global framework for this. We want all stakeholders to be engaged. Everyone has a role to play. We are hearing a lot of topics, innovative finance, blended, de-risking. So it's very important to put a plan going forward where each stakeholder and its role is quite well understood and there's complementarity.
Egyptian Minister for International Cooperation, Dalia Al-Mashat. Climate change-related shocks such as prolonged drought, floods, and locust infestation have displaced thousands of Somali farmers from the land, threatening food security in the Horn of the African state. Muhammad Kahiye has more from the capital, Mogadishu.
Somalia contributes less than 0.003% of greenhouse gas emissions into the atmosphere. But the impact of global warming is evident in the well-being of the country's herders and farmers. Fatuma Ibrahim Aden, a mother of eight, is among thousands of farmers currently living in a displaced persons camp in Mogadishu after her family's livestock succumbed to the escalating drought in Qoryooli in the lower Shabelle region. She says prolonged drought and lack of water that killed their livestock forced her extended family to the city 4 months ago. She added that they haven't experienced such recurring famine in recent years. Dr. Ibrahim Dakane Ali is a Somali agriculture and resilience specialist. He says there is need for new strategies to mitigate the impact on the lives of the farmers.
And without getting assistance or climate investment and installation of climate smart technologies, it will be difficult. Plus other issues of environmental conservation, regenerative agriculture, new use of renewable energy. All these elements will definitely, but above all, we need to educate our population. And to do that, it's a sole responsibility of the government to stand up and address this one.
The Somali government has called upon richer nations emitting most of the greenhouse gases to act swiftly as the climate conference continues in Glasgow.
Somalia and other poor countries are paying with their lives and livelihoods for a problem not of our making. It is therefore our loud call to the countries emitting the most to start acting on the issue, especially so now that we know what the problem is and we know the action is needed.
The world's richest countries once pledged to deliver $100 billion per year to help developing nations cope with climate change, a pledge that has never been met. Mohamed Kahir for VOA News in Mogadishu, Somalia.
As climate change causes more disruption across Africa, some farmers and organizations are adopting measures they hope will minimize the impact. In Kenya, a group has invested in cold storage facilities to ensure that excess produce that would have otherwise become gas-producing waste is collected, stored, and distributed to those in need, including victims of drought. Brenda Mlinya reports from Nairobi.
Lilian Vihenda prepares afternoon porridge for her young children. The flour she uses has just been delivered by the staff at Food Bank in Kenya, a non-profit organization that helps feed the needy in this Nairobi neighborhood. In the current hard economic times in Kenya, Vihenda says these care packages help keep her children in school. She says that the money that she would have used to buy food that she now gets from the bank will pay for her children's school fees, which is a great help. But in addition to helping the poor by salvaging excess food from farms and markets, Food Bank in Kenya is taking steps to blunt the harmful impact of climate change. John Gadungu, who heads the nonprofit, says the recent acquisition of a cold storage facilities allows the food bank to store more food while reducing greenhouse emissions from the farms.
When food in the farms ends up in the landfills, you find that there is a lot of toxicity within the air, because what happens is that when they rot in the landfill, they produce methane, which is a worse product than carbon dioxide. And if we curb food wastage, we can be able at least to reduce the amount of gas that is produced from at least 6 to 8%.
Implementing climate-sensitive advances will be key to helping Africa adapt and mitigate the effects of climate change, says Adaption Strategies analyst Winnie Haemba.
Agricultural technologies that also ensure that you have reduced CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions, methane emissions, and so on, which are all greenhouse gases, are really, really important. So we really are in need of these technologies and then also the capacity to be able to apply these technologies and so on.
But technology requires funding, and that remains a challenge. Experts say the continent will need more than $300 billion over the next decade as it develops strategies that will help cushion it from the effects of climate change. Brenda Malinya for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
Ahead of World Diabetes Day on Sunday, the African Office of the World Health Organization is warning that the chronic disease leaves patients especially vulnerable to the effects of COVID-19. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare, Zimbabwe's capital, where the government is building rural health centers to make it easier for people with diabetes and other conditions to get medical attention.
Dr. Benido Impouma, Director of Communicable and Non-Communicable Diseases Cluster at WHO Regional Office for Africa, said with just 6% of the continent's population fully vaccinated, COVID-19 still poses a very real threat to populations in Africa, especially people with diabetes. He said WHO's preliminary analysis shows that death rates from COVID-19 are significantly higher in patients who also have diabetes. The UN Health Agency's survey in 13 African countries found a more than 10% case fatality rate for people with diabetes compared to 2.5% for COVID-19 patients overall, said Impouma.
This shows that fighting the diabetes epidemic in Africa is in many ways as critical as the battle against the current COVID-19 pandemic. COVID-19 will eventually subside, but Africa is projected in the coming years to experience the highest increase in diabetes globally. We must act now to prevent new cases. All Africans at risk of diabetes must have access to testing. In fact, in Africa, about 70% of people with diabetes are unaware that they have the chronic condition.
The WHO says about 24 million Africans suffer from diabetes, with that number expected to rise sharply in coming years. Impouma urged health officials to take advantage of the increased availability of low-cost rapid diagnostic tests to routinely test patients to ensure early detection and proper care. Joyce Kanegebiza is a diabetes patient in Zimbabwe. She says she's happy about improvements to health centers in her rural home, Mount Darwin, about 200 kilometers north of Harare. She says, we used to walk long distance to get tested or get medication. I'm happy that I do not have to travel long distances anymore. We now get tested here at a clinic instead of going to hospital. Zimbabwe's Vice President Constantino Chiwenga, who doubles as the country's health minister, told the state-owned broadcaster that such health centers can also be key venues for COVID-19 vaccination.
We have distributed and will continue to distribute effectively our centers in all our districts so that people can now move to those areas, get tested, get their supplies, and always get reviewed.
The WHO says its data revealed that in about 40 African countries, nearly 14% of all COVID-19 vaccine doses administered so far have gone to Africans with underlying conditions such as diabetes. But the organization says it is still nowhere near where it wants Africa to be with protecting the continent's most vulnerable populations. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
This is the Voice of America, and you are listening to Netland Africa. And coming up in the second half of the program, the Saturday Music Spot from our collection of music from across the continent.
But first,
visually impaired people too often struggle to get ahead, especially in developing countries, including Zimbabwe. But Zimbabwe this month appointed its first visually impaired judge to the country's High Court bench. Columbus Mavinga reports from Harare.
46-year-old Samuel Deme made history when he became Zimbabwe's first visually impaired person to make it to the country's High Court. After he lost his sight at the age of six because of measles, he says he did not want to continue depending on his peasant farmer parents. He worked hard to excel at school until he earned two law degrees at the University of Zimbabwe. Fear of failure and a need to escape poverty drove him to such heights.
I was also aware that if I miss doing good at school, the next thing would be on the streets begging for assistance. So that was one of my worst fears. I thought that I could liberate myself from poverty by advancing my educational interests, by continuing to work hard in education so that I could be able to also to liberate my parents who are peasant farmers. One of them is now late, my father, who passed on last year. They worked hard for me using the limited resources. Those fears of the unknown were major drivers of myself, ensure that I ran away from poverty.
To enable his work, Deme has documents translated into Braille or has a computer read them out. He says he can work alone once he learns the layout of a building. Visually impaired 27-year-old Darlington Nkomazana works as a researcher at the Judiciary Service Commission of Zimbabwe. He says the appointment of Deme as a High Court judge demonstrated that there is room for everyone and that Deme's achievement has inspired him and revived his childhood wishes to become a judge.
And as a pioneer, he has demonstrated that even those who will come, they will be able to do the same. So I think he's just opened a way for many who are to come, who may have aspirations to be judges.
Leonard Marange, director of the Federation of Organizations of Disabled People in Zimbabwe, says the appointment of Deme to the High Court bench is a positive example for the community.
So for government to have considered him for such an esteemed position, we're quite excited. And of course, we want more to be done, but this is a very gigantic step in the right direction. It's a remarkable development for us in the disability community, in the disability sector.
Calling it a milestone meant to give all Zimbabweans equal opportunity to employment regardless of disability, Walter Chikwana, the Secretary of the Judicial Service Commission of Zimbabwe, said the government would ensure access to justice to people with disabilities like Justice Deme and Nkomazana. Chikwana says that merit-based appointments open space for equal opportunities.
It's not a favor to these two gentlemen. It's because they have the capacity and they are capable. That's why they are occupying the positions that they are occupying. And us as the employer, what is important is to provide a good environment for them to be able to do their work.
Justice Deme hopes to become a Supreme Court or a constitutional judge one day. He says his appointment shows people aspiring to higher government offices that hard work eventually pays off. Columbus Mavungam for VOA News, Harare, Zimbabwe.
And now it's time for a Saturday music spot. Yes, time to relax and enjoy great music from Africa.
If you would feel my soul, come near, sweetie. Why don't you give me more, stand boy?
Hey.
If you would feel my soul, come do this, sweetie.
Hey. Ruvara, mi foti nesia. Rangu shicha buda, kusiga wafara. You don't wanna leave me, baby, do you? Everything I say from my heart so true.
Yeah, 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 yeah. Stand by me, envision and see a world we built with endless possibility.
Și piperul, ca soarele și luna, colorăm cerul. Suntem ca piperul și sarea, dar mai rar împreună, ca muntele și marea. Noi doi, wasabi, oregano, la vita e bella, comisii din cen italian. Nu vreau să ne certăm când dai focat tabasco și nu-mi repare inima nici dacă-mi fac casco. Dar suntem împreună fără niciun stres, condimente pentru o rețetă de succes.
Pasiune, nici pe șapte continente. Am zis ca noi doi, două condimente. Sare și piperul ne pe șapte continente. Două condimente, două condimente. Pe șapte continente, șapte continente.
picant, gencili sau boia, doar că eu mănânc mai light, fii tu sosul meu de soia. Eu busuioc, eu cu mentă, relația nu-i perfectă, dar are o tentă. Paprika din India, știi că tu ești unica, deci fiind ca vanilia, una la un milia. O văd și oamenii mei, ci că ăștia doi se potrivesc, nu știm alții ca ei. Dar suntem împreună fără niciun stres, condimente pentru o rețetă de succes. Doamne,
sunt noi, plin de sentimente, plin de pasiune, niște șapte continente. Am zis că mai doi, două condimente, sare și viperul de pe șapte continente. Două condimente, două condimente, de pe șapte continente, șapte continente. Vorbești cu tine în zile întregi, vorbești și mai. Adresată după capul meu, dar nici tu nu spui nu. Și seara sunt acasă, plătite cu Nutella. Foarte clasic, ca Arșină și Stella. Am zis că noi doi, plin de sentimente, plin de pasiune, niște șapte continente. Am zis că noi doi, două condimente, sare și viperul de pe șapte continente.
Was our Saturday Music Spot. I sincerely hope you enjoyed the music. Nightline Africa comes to you on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC from the English service of the Voice of America and from the rest of the Nightline Africa team. We thank you for joining us tonight. And join us tomorrow, Sunday. I'm Douglas Mpoga.